When I mentioned this lecture to any number of people that I know, almost every one of them said to me, yes, I've read this book by Tali Lan, that book by Tali Lan, this chapter was assigned in my course, that chapter was assigned in my course. So we know her prodigious efforts and her prodigious work in the field of women's history in the Talmudic period. Tal is also known for her study of Jewish names, and she's published the definitive work on Jewish names of late antiquity, Palestine, names in Palestine, 330 BCE to 200 CE. But now, as people are getting settled, let me add a couple of things that most of you do not know. Marjorie Lehman and I, who were involved in Tal's project, were recently in Germany at a conference just a few weeks ago in Berlin, and I saw what I already knew to be true, and that is that Tal has Hasidot and Hasidim. That is to say, Tal, who is, of course, from Israel, but now lives in Berlin or teaches in Berlin, has assembled around herself a whole group of young German students, many female, also male. They have traveled to Israel to learn Hebrew, then they've come back to Germany, and they study Talmud with Tal. Sounds good, Talmud with Tal. Yeah. But some of them have graduated with their PhDs and are now writing volumes in this feminist commentary. She is their Rebbe. And in biblical Hebrew, we would say, Ki osa nefashot. So tonight, I'm not the speaker, she's the speaker, so I'm concluding right now. I haven't said half enough of what one could say about Tal, but I cleared this with her. You can read more about her by Googling her. You will get a glimpse tonight of what her students get to see on a regular basis.
Hi.
Hello, hello. I've got a number of...
Is this working? Is this supposed to work?
Does that work?
I don't know. I'm not the TV person.
The mic.
I think you can manage without a mic. This is a classroom.
I could probably manage without a mic. Okay, so I'm
why don't you give it the mic?
I'm just going to stand like this.
If you have a mic, you might as well use it.
I don't know the first thing about any of this technology.
How are we supposed
Hector,
to
do we know on? Anything about
the mic? You talk right into it, it's on.
It's not on. I'm talking
no,
right
it's not on. I can hear it's not amplified.
That's for the
just give us a second. We'll see what's happening.
Can you hear? Oh, now you can hear. Okay, we can actually probably make it a little quieter. Okay, I think everybody can hear now. Right, I'm going to sort of stand here a little by the side. I need to stand close enough to look at my computer to do this, but I'm going to try and see everybody here. And so I was asked to sort of try and do two things, and one of them is to present my our project, the feminist commentary on the Talmud, and also it was supposed to be as a sort of book presentation, and since from my perspective the only book that I have written that has come out of this series is a commentary on Masechet Ta'anit, I decided that I would concentrate then on Masechet Ta'anit. So what is a feminist commentary to the Talmud? I hope the people here more or less have an idea what the Talmud is, but just, you know, in the most basic terms, there's these two compositions which are built one on top of the other. There's the Mishnah, it was written around about, or it was compiled and sealed round about 200 of our era in the land of Israel under the supervision of a rabbinic assembly or a rabbinic study house headed by Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Rabbi Yehuda the patriarch, and immediately, you know, sort of like on Friday, they finished it. On Saturday they rested, on Shabbat they rested, and then on Yom Rishon they started commenting on it, and they wrote the commentary. I always ask, my question is, why did they do it like that? And I usually explain, well, you know, to create the Mishnah, they had created this enormous bureaucratic academic system where you had all these rabbis and the students and the rabbis. So what did they do? Did they say, right, we finished the Mishnah, go home? It doesn't work like that. Nobody in his right mind who's an academic would, you know, with his own hands destroy the system that they built. And there were the study houses and so on. So the next thing they did is they started interpreting it. And of course, the result of this interpretation is that Talmud, and not only did they not destroy the system that they had already built, in fact, they started exporting it. And of course, the main object of this export project was Babylonia. With the result that there were two Talmudim that were created, the Talmud of Eretz Israel, the Yerushalmi, and the Talmud of Babylonia, the Bavli, and for some historical weird reasons, which I will not discuss now, the result is that the Babylonian Talmud is today the authoritative text of the Jews, and because it's the authoritative text of the Jews, in this commentary, which we decided to take upon ourselves, we decided that we would be commenting on the Babylonian Talmud, on the Bavli. The Yerushalmi is a very interesting, I would almost say, esoteric text. It's not really well known. But the Bavli is still today an absolutely vital part of the Jewish curriculum. And if you're going to be a Jew, a proper practicing Jew, you should at least be acquainted with the basics of what the Talmud is and what it says. And we saw, as part of what a feminist commentary is the idea that, in fact, the entire feminist project, or what I call, I didn't invent it, but what is called second wave feminism, and the project of second wave feminism, which is more an academic project, is to critique patriarchal institutions that were created a long time ago and still influence the way women are conceived, and the way gender is conceived, and the way the division of labor between the sexes works. And of course, the Babylonian Talmud being the authoritative text is the text that we decided to comment upon. And so I conceived this as this is what we want to do, I realized immediately that the project was like enormous, and the reason it's so big is because the Talmud itself. I mean, if you look at the Bible, everybody can hold a Bible in his hand. It's like this small book. But I haven't seen people walking around. I mean, maybe today with the internet, and you know, you can have an iPhone, and on the iPhone you can have the Talmud. I'm not saying it's not possible. But when I started studying, it wasn't possible. Nobody went around with a Talmud in his pocket or on his back or something like that. It just didn't work that way. It's a huge library. And of course, if we're going to comment on it, even if you can put it on an iPhone, it's still an enormous it's still an enormous book or books or an enormous composition that has to work on an iPhone. So I said to myself, you have to be practical and you have to think about what are we going to comment on and how are we going to do it. And so I decided basically that we will start with one order. And we started it about 4 years ago. A little more than 4 years ago, we began this project. And so I said to myself, what are we going to decide to begin with? And I said, we're going to begin with the order of Moed festivals, because it is obvious to me, and I hope it's obvious to most of the people sitting here, that the one thing that makes a Jew more than anything else is the yearly cycle, the Jewish yearly cycle, which is what is the most important thing that we find in Seder Moed. Because, if you look, for example, at Seder Nezikin, which deals with criminal and personal law, And you would look at something like inheritance, and you would see the kind of inheritance problems that they deal with. Do we give it to the firstborn? What does the secondborn get? How do we divide it? Can a father write a will and give all his property to the secondborn instead of the firstborn? Now look, this is all very interesting, but does it make somebody particularly Jewish? Because, I mean, they can read it in Hebrew, it's wonderful, it's in the Talmud. But is that a problem that makes somebody particularly Jewish? I don't think so. But if you see, the fall coming, and there they are, all those people putting up these strange little huts and sitting in them for 7-8 days, then you know you're looking at Jews. Then you know this is Jewish. So I decided that we should start with Seder Moed, with the festivals, and that was the beginning of my project. So let's see. So we started with Seder Moed, and now I'm going to show you what an international project this is by telling you who's taking part in it. This is Arya Cohen from Los Angeles, and he's writing for us about Masechet Shabbat. And this is Charlotta von Robert. She's from Stanford, and she's writing about Eruvin. And you know who this one is. And she's writing for us about Psachim. This is Andreas Lennart, and I have to say he's writing about Shkalim. Now, I have to say something here as a sort of parenthesis. For some reason, the Babylonian Talmud there is no commentary of the Babylonian Talmud on absolutely every Masechet that was written in the Mishnah. One of the Masechtot, for some weird reason, Shkalim, does not have a Babylonian Talmud to it at all. But if you go to the to a library and you take off, you know, you go and you see the whole Babylonian Talmud standing there, there is a Masechet of Shkalim, and you can take it off the shelf and open it, and it'll look exactly like every other Masechet you've ever seen in your life, and you'll very nicely think that it's part of the Babylonian Talmud. So I have to warn you that it isn't. It's a text from the Talmud Yerushalmi, from the Talmud of the Land of Israel. And the reason why it's being printed like that, and why it's there to confuse us and to make us think things that are happen to be not true at all, is because from a very early stage, since Shkalim did not have a Babylonian Talmud to it, people began not just, I was going to say, to print the Shkalim from the Yerushalmi together with the Babylonian Talmud, but this goes deeper, because we have evidence, which is pre-print evidence, in the famous big Munich manuscript, which is the completest manuscript of the entire Babylonian Talmud, the only one that is extant, which includes the entire text. And when you flip through it and come to Shkalim, you find the Yerushalmi text copied in hand, in a manuscript from the Yerushalmi inside the Munich manuscript. So, in fact, we can see that in the case of Shkalim, the Yerushalmi text has become the authoritative text on the same level as the other Masechtot of the Babli. And so when I came to Masechet Shkalim, I decided that I wanted somebody to comment on it. And Andreas Lennart, who is a colleague of mine from Mainz in Germany, has devoted many years of his life to translating Tractats from the Yerushalmi into German, and I thought that he would be the sort of the right person to do it, and I'm very happy that he agreed. Right, and now you know this person too, and she's involved in Masechet Yoma. And this is Shulamit Vala from Haifa, and she wrote, published Masechet Sukkah. This is my student Tamara Oh from Berlin. And I particularly brought her book with me, Masechet Beitza, because it's just, we just got it last week as a published project, so I wanted to bring it here and show it, so maybe you want to see it around. This is another student of mine, Dorothea Salzer, and she will be writing about Rosh Hashanah. You know who this is? And I wrote about Ta'anit, which is what the subject of this paper is going to be today. And we have Judith Baskin, who will write from Oregon. Eugene, Oregon, she's writing about Megillah. And Klaus Hermann, my colleague from Berlin, who is an expert on the Heichalot literature, so he's going to write about Chagiga, because Chagiga has a lot to do with the Heichalot literature. And Gay Leibovitz, I think she studied here once, right?
PhD.
Yeah. And she's in Los Angeles now, and she's doing Moed Katan. So here you have the entire Seder Moed, which we began and we are working on. Some of it is already published. So we have this is the first book that came out. It's an introduction, which was a conference that was held in Berlin 4 years ago, in which you participated, and this was the first book that came out. What happened there? Sorry.
The screen.
Oh. And, okay, and this is Masechet Ta'anit. This was the book I wrote, and it came out second, and then we had Masechet Sukkah, and this is... And this is what we did with, and now we have Pizza, which you have going around there. We're sort of dividing, I'm going to do this quickly, we're sort of dividing the rest of the Talmud and going on, working on this. Seder Zra'im doesn't have a Talmud to it except for one Masechet. So here it is. This is Elizabeth Alexander, and she's doing Brachot. She's in Virginia. And this is a student of mine. She's called Reut Khan, and she's doing only the Mishnah, but the entire Seder Zra'im, which is it's an enormous project. And then we have Seder Tohorot. We have the same story with Seder Tohorot. There's only one Masechet in Seder Tohorot that has a Babylonian Talmud to it, and that's Masechet Nidah, which Tirza Mitchum is doing, and my student, Christiana Shtoya, is doing Mishnah Tohorot, the entire Mishnah and not the Talmud. And now we're at this phase where we're doing Seder Kodashim. Seder Kodashim is devoted to sacrifices, and we just had, this is the conference that Judy mentioned in Berlin that we had a few weeks ago, where we had the opportunity to invite people to talk about sacrifices, Kodashim, and basically about women in the temple. So the people we have here, just very quickly, Susanna Plitsch, she's now from Salzburg, she just became a professor there, she's doing Zvachim. Dvorah Weisberg from the Hebrew Union College in Los Angeles, Menachot, you know this person. Chulin, this is me. Moshe Lavi from Haifa University is doing Pchorot. And Jane Kanarek from Boston College. No,
yes.
No.
Hebrew College.
And so Boston College is something else, I know. Arachin. Then we have Federico Dalbo. He's a student of mine. He's doing Kritot. Monica Brockhaus, another student of mine. She's doing Tmura. Sarah Lev from the Reconstructionist College near Philadelphia. She's doing Meila. And Dalia Marx from the Hebrew Union College in Jerusalem. And she's doing actually two tractates which have only a Mishnah to them, Kinim and Midot. And Tractat Tamid, which has some Talmud to it, but very little. So we decided to put this all together. So this is the team we have at this point who are participating in this project. And now I'm going to begin by explaining what I mean by a feminist commentary. And I want to give an example using Masechet Ta'anit. which was my first project and which I felt, which I feel is like, I mean, it can still be an example of how I see this working. What I want, what I ask people to do is I ask the people to read the Masechet and to think, can we say something unique about gender which has to do with this Masechet and which nobody has noticed before and nobody looked at and which will help us understand how this Masechet contributes towards the understanding of gender in Jewish tradition. And my experience has been that regardless of what you think before you began reading these texts, once you start reading them, something's going to happen and you're going to start seeing things you never thought you were going to see. So this is how Masechet Taanit begins. Begins with the words, Me'ematai maskirim gevurot gshamim. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Miyom Tov HaRishon Shel Chag, Rabbi Yoshua Omer, Miyom Tov HaCharon Shel Chag. So I also have a translation of this text here, but in basically if you look at it now, I'll give a sort of a general sort of conventional translation. From when does one mention the strength or power of rain? Rabbi Eliezer says from the first day of the festival. Rabbi Yoshua says from the last day of the festival. So my question is, why should this text at all interest somebody who's questioning gender and gender concepts and gender hierarchies, why should it interest anyone at all? And my answer is that once I read this a bit more differently, in a new way, I noticed something quite interesting. And that is this word that's painted in red here, and that is Gevurot Geshamim, which is actually the crux. When people try to translate this text, this is where they get into trouble. And I've seen all kinds of ways of trying to get over and around this Gevurot Geshamim, because everybody thinks that Gevurot Geshamim comes from Gevura, from heroism or power or something like that. But actually, if we look at the root of the word Gevurot, it's Gimel Bet Reish, and that's the root for Gevel. In other words, it's something masculine, very masculine. So, what did I do when I translated the text? From what time does one begin mentioning virile rain? Rabbi Eliezer says from the first day of the festival of Sukkot, and Rabbi Yoshua says from the last day of the festival of Sukkot. Now, why do I use the word virile? Because the word vir in Latin is men. It's the same as the gever. And what I try to do by this translation is to notify and to sort of point the reader to that we have rain is here identified as masculine. It's powerful, it's heroic, but it's also masculine. And if that were the end of the story, people could come and say to me, so what? But it's not the end of the story, okay? So what's the rain doing? In Tosefta Taanit 1:4 we read, and this is the Tosefta. Before I read the text, I have to say a word about the Tosefta. Of course, for people, I think most of the people sitting here in the audience, you would know that we have this weird composition that goes together with the Mishnah. It doesn't have any authority of the kind that the Mishnah has, but was composed more or less at the same time. And this other composition, the Tosefta, it actually runs in the same way that the Mishnah runs. It has the same chapters and it follows it quite closely. But in many respects, if you read the Mishnah together with the Tosefta, one next to the other, you will notice that either the Tosefta has something to add to the Mishnah, or sometimes, and this is something that Judaism has shown, and we are very thankful to her. Sometimes it's actually the other way around. The Mishnah has something to add to the Tosefta, or the Mishnah is intentionally contradicting and removing something from the Tosefta. And there's a big question which is still going on about what comes first, the Mishnah or the Tosefta. But from us, our point of view, from a feminist perspective, which is what I'm trying to explain how I think this has to work here, the Tosefta is very important because it is what I call in my jargon a rejected text. It's not authoritative. So if we want to know what kind of things would have been or could have been said next to the Mishnah, but were never made authoritative, we should read the Tosefta, and often we will find what has been rejected, or as Judy had said, the road not taken. One of the things you will see as the book goes around is that often the Mishnah is printed in our commentary as a parallel to the Tosefta. We bring the two texts. Now, this text, for example, doesn't exist in the Mishnah. So I'm going to read the text and I'm going to explain what the Mishnah does have and explain what the Tosefta adds here. So the Tosefta says, Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar, En lecha kol tefach v'tefach sheyored milemala, אין הארץ פולטת כנגדו תפחיים. וכן הוא אומר, תהום אל תהום קורה. למה נקרא רביעה שרובעת את הארץ? Now, I'm going to do it the other way around. I'm going to start with the second part, which is marked in yellow here, and I'll go back to the first part afterwards. I just brought it in the way that it's written, and then I'll explain, and then you'll see the translation. So, the second part is, למה נקרא רביעה? Why is it called רביעה? And you had to ask, why is the Tosefta asking this? I mean, the word רביעה has been mentioned before. And the answer is, it's saying this because it's been mentioned in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, the first רביעה, which means the first rainfall, and then it says, the second רביעה, רביעה ראשונה, רביעה שנייה, רביעה שלישית. And the Mishnah uses this expression to describe rainfall. And it's an unusual expression because it doesn't come from any, it doesn't come from the same root as matar or as geshem or anything like that. So the Tosefta asks, why is it called revi'ah? And the answer, she'ovat et ha'aretz. Now we have to translate this, and the translation is a bit embarrassing. Because, you know, I'm saying this because I read Agnon not a long time ago in a very, very different way than I would have read him otherwise before I started dealing with Tanit, and he was talking all the time about Ve'az yarda revi'ah rishona, the first rainfall fell, and so on, so on. What are you talking about? Do you know what you're saying? What is revi'ah? It's really embarrassing. But it's become such a usual expression to use that nobody even notices what they're saying. So I'll tell you what it means. Revi'ah means, it's quite a grotesque word for sexual intercourse, but it's not a sexual intercourse. It's more like what the male does to the female. I've actually, and this is what I do here, I translate it with the word copulation, which is not a very beautiful word.
Not impregnation.
What? Impregnation. Because I think impregnation has the idea that somebody's going to get pregnant here. And revi'ah doesn't have the ibur in it. It's not from the same. So I'm careful about it.
The idea is to soften it up so that it will accept seed. That's what the
Talmud says. This is the word I use, and I used intentionally a gross expression because it's the Hebrew is not very delicate either. So actually, in case somebody suspected that my translation, virile rain, is not what the rabbis intended, well, they tell you that they do. What does the rain do? It comes and it copulates with the land. And this is the other interesting thing that happens, and that's the first part of the text. They said, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar says, every for every hand breadth that falls from above, the land responds by emitting double the amount. As it is written, and then you have a Psalms citation. What does it mean, the land emits double the amount? And we have in Hebrew, She'en ha'aretz poletet kenegdo. What is the land emitting? Now the point that for me is important here is this expression poletet, this word poletet. If you do something that we can do, and which I think two generations ago nobody could do, you open the responsa data bank and you type in poletet, you'll have a very interesting discovery that, except for one case, the word, which I'm not going to quote here, but the word appears like 16 or 17 times in rabbinic texts, and I'm going to show you that the word poletet, okay, emitting poletet, appears always with poletet shichvat zera. She emits semen. So when the rain comes down, the land emits something kenigdo. And I'm just going to show you. This is in Mishnah Shabbat. This is in Mishnah Mikvaot. Here she's only poletet zera, not shichvat zera. But this is in Tosefta Nida. This is in Tosefta Mikvaot. And this is in the Mechilta de Rabbi Ishmael, Apoletet Shechvat Zera, and this is in the Sifrat Azriah. So this is all from Tanaitic texts, and okay, all right, sorry. So this is all in Tanaitic texts, and you can see that it's always the same expression. So I think that if we go back to our the land emitting, we have to assume that the Shechvat Zera is there, and it's the sort of the sexual cosmic sexual relationship between the rain and the land is what is going on here. Yes, please.
Well, in the Chulin, you have the whole concept of pole or pole, which has nothing to do with sexuality. It has to do with...
Yes, but you yourself, excuse me, but you yourself said polet. Now, I intentionally said the word poletet because I looked at poletet as the feminine form, and it's always with shichvat zera as poletet. So there is a difference. I'm not saying you're wrong about what you're saying. I'm just saying that if you look at it in from the feminine form, this is what happens. It's something quite surprising that happens when you look at it like that. Yeah, okay?
Actually, it's masculine there.
What? Poletet?
Kach poltol.
Yeah, I'm not arguing about that. I am saying that poletet is not masculine. What? And it appears like this. So I want... And by the way, it's a very interesting concept, because in rabbinic literature we have a concept that suggests that not that in sexual relations it's not just men who emit semen. Women have semen too, and they emit them too at the process of sexual intercourse. And so the poletet shichvat zera is what a woman does when she has sexual intercourse, and that's why it's so fascinating that it also happens with the land. So, okay. So this is, in general, when we talk about Masechet Tanit, and we see that there's a very interesting linguistic level where the entire question of what we do with rainfall, and of course I'm very good at avoiding the first part where I have to explain what Masechet Tanit is all about. Tanit means fasting. And the point is that it turns out that in the land of Israel, at the time that we're talking about, you fast when you think God is angry with you, and you fast in order to ask for repent and to ask for forgiveness, and so you can do it when there's a war, when there's famine, when there's all kinds of catastrophes, a landslide, an earthquake, a volcano, a hurricane, everything can be a good reason to fast. But it turns out that the most frequent reason why people fasted is because it didn't rain. And I have to tell you that I know for sure that this year too, there have already been at least two fasts declared in Israel because of the rain failure, which is absolutely catastrophic. It's never been as bad since I can remember. So just to let you know that it's a very imminent and problematic issue. So Masechet Tanit is about fasting, and what I just did now is explain that actually when you look at Masechet at the issue of fasting, when you look at the Masechet and the way it's built, I just said it talks in language which describes rainfall as a sort of a cosmic sexual relationship. That's what's happening. There's rain falling, there's the land emitting, and there's some sort of wonderful, very, very hilarious and grandiose orgy between the rain and the land. And of course, we need it, so it's a good thing. Basically, we're for it. What happens when it doesn't rain? Then we fast. Most of the fasts are intended to be instituted when it doesn't rain. So now, what I want to do now is to see how fasting influences is described in Masechet Tanit, and to try to understand what's going on here in the fasting, because of course a fast is a sort of a ritual. So what is this ritual doing? So I particularly chose this beautiful picture from Witzi Gottlieb of Yom Kippur, because although Yom Kippur you don't fast for rainfall, you fast. And so this picture is about Jews fasting. So I chose this picture, and I'm going to look at Masechet Tanit, chapter 1, Mishnayot 4 to 7. Why do I have 4 to 6 in English and Dalet to Zayin? I have to do my own text. So this is the text in Hebrew, and this is the text in English, and I'll read the text in English. When the 17th of Malcheshvan arrives and rain has not fallen, individuals begin to fast 3 fasts. They eat and drink when dark and are permitted to work and wash and anoint and wear shoes and engage in sexual relations. And it says in Hebrew, "Betashmish hamita," so I wrote here, literally use the bed. When the first of Kislev arrives and rain has not fallen, the court institutes 3 public fasts. They eat and drink when dark and are permitted to work and wash and anoint and wear shoes and engage in sexual relations. So in the first Mishnah, we have a situation where everybody fasts. But they fast, it says, they eat and drink when dark. Which means that this is the description of a fast that starts in the morning. You don't eat and drink, you don't stop eating and drinking when it gets dark. You get up in the morning and you start fasting. It's not a Yom Kippur fast sort of thing. And you are, and you work, what?
Sounds like Ramadan.
No, well, and you, but it's for one day, and it's only individuals who are sort of holy individuals are supposed to do it, and you can, and you are permitted. You don't eat and drink, but you're permitted to work and to wash and to anoint and to wear sandals and to have sexual intercourse. And then when the first of Kislev has arrived, I mean after Chanukah, then everybody is supposed to fast, and you fast 3 times, but it's still a simple fast. You start in the morning, and you eat and drink, and you are permitted to work and wash and anoint and wear sandals and so on. But when these have passed and they're not answered, the court institutes 3 more public fasts. They eat and drink on the previous day and are forbidden to work and wash and anoint and wear shoes and engage in sexual relations. And they lock up the bathhouses. In case somebody thinks it's the right time to go to the bathhouse, they lock the bathhouses. But I think what I like about this description is, let us think what's going on here. What are the things that are forbidden? Because the word ta'anit, it means we use it today to talk about fasts, but actually the word ta'anit is associated with inui, with self affliction. So if you afflict yourself, what are you supposed to do? And this is what is so nice about Mishnah Ta'anit. They say you're not supposed to eat and drink, you're not supposed to wash and anoint, and finally you're not supposed to have sexual relations. And I identify this very clearly. This fast is like, because there's no rain, the land does not get food, does not get water, it's not washed, it's not anointed, and come on, it doesn't have sex. So we imitate the land. The ritual of Ta'anit is an imitation. We don't eat, we don't drink, we don't wash, we don't anoint, we don't have sex. And this is the basic concept of what the fast of Ta'anit is. It's an imitation of the land and the rain.
What about the Ilat Asanta?
I don't know. I thought about it often and I have no idea. If somebody wants to come up with an idea, it's fine. I mean, I should have said it. I should have said I don't know what to do with the sand. But I don't know. It may be taken from it may be sort of, you know, because the description is like in Yom Kippur, so it may be taken from there as a sort of, because we don't do it in Yom Kippur, we do. But I don't know. I don't know. So what I want to do now, this is the Mishnah, and this is how I conceptualize the whole thing in the Mishnah. Now I want to bring some examples about how this works in the Talmud. Because things happen when we look at the way these texts are interpreted in the Talmud, which only magnify this concept that I have developed here. So this is the first text. First of all, you can see in this text that I brought here, you have the thin cows and the fat cows. This is from the Joseph story. Because the Joseph story gets mentioned here, because, of course, this is where you have the best famine you can think of. But the point that I want to talk about here is, you can see how I work here. We have the Babylonian Talmud on the right side and the Yerushalmi on the left side, which is the purpose of this is really what I tried to say, that we don't read the Babylonian Talmud on its own. We try to read it with the texts that were rejected. And I think this is a wonderful example. This text that I have here is a wonderful example of the difference between the way the ritual of Ta'anit was understood in the land of Israel and in Babylonia, in Eretz Israel. In Eretz Israel, it was understood really as an emergency issue that had to do with the terrible situation that it doesn't rain. But in Babylonia, they didn't really understand this, because they never knew what it was all about. They always had water. They didn't have a problem. There were the rivers, and you could water the land with the canals that you brought, that you dug between the rivers, and it was completely irrelevant if it rained or not. And they say that. Once in a while we have texts where they say Babylonia is preferable to Israel because it is not dependent on the capricious will of God to rain or not. And they actually put that as a sort of an argument why you should prefer, why it seems that God sometimes prefers Babylonia. There's an argument about it, but they say this. But what I want to show you is this text that has to do with what is allowed and what is forbidden when it rains. So, Amar Reish Lakish, Asur le'adam l'shamesh mitato b'shnei re'avon, sh'ne'emar v'le'yosef yulad shnei banim b'terem tavo shnat ha'ra'av. Tanach hasuchei banim meshamshim mitotehen bishnei ra'av. So in Eretz is so. Sorry, I should have started with the other one. I'll start with the Eretz Yisrael. Amar Rabbi Abun k'tiv b'chesed uv'chefen galmud. B'sha'a sh'at ro'e chisaron ba'al ha'olam aseh ishtecha galmuda. Amar Rabbi Levi k'tiv u'le'yosef yulad shnei banim. E'i matai? B'terem tavo shnat ha'ra'av. Tani b'shem Rabbi Yehuda te'evei banim meshamshim mitoteihen. It is written, lonely from want and starvation. When you see want enter the world, make your wife lonely. Very interesting suggestion. In other words, because there isn't what to anything to eat, you should not engage in having more children. When you see that there's not going to be enough food for another mouth to feed, don't make more children. This is what it's saying. And Rabbi Levi says, it is written that Joseph became the father of two sons, and we know that there was this terrible famine in Egypt before the years of famine came. Because when the years of famine came, Joseph behaved like a good, God-fearing Jew and did not produce more sons. But then it goes on and says, it is taught Tana, so it's a Tanaitic tradition in the name of Rabbi Yehuda, those who desire sex, sons engage in sexual relations in year of famine. Said Rabbi Yossi, provided they do so on the day she immerses, which is not very interesting here. But what is interesting to me is he says those who desire sons do engage in sexual relations in years of famine. The word in Hebrew is te'evei banim, and te'ev is not a positive word. It is those who really think that they must have sons. They sort of squander the very little that there is around them and have sons on and have sex on in years of plenty and in years of famine. And in my opinion, this is criticism. Rabbi Yehuda is not happy about it, and he says this should not happen. But in the Babylonian Talmud, the same, if it's a brighter, it says, "Chasuchei banim meshamshim mitotehen bishnei ravon." And chasuchei banim means people who do not have sons, and that's a positive expression. Tevei banim is negative. You shouldn't want to have children in such a situation. But the Babylonian Talmud says, if you don't have children, then you're allowed. If you don't have sons, then you are allowed to have sex during years of famine. What I think the difference is exactly the difference between the concept in Babylonia and the concept in the land of Israel. The concept in the land of Israel is it's dangerous to have sons in years of famine because it's going to endanger everybody. The pregnant woman, the child who's going to be born, it's going to leave less food for other people. But in the Babylonian Talmud, if the whole issue is only a ritual and you forbid people to have sex, then there's another law. And the other law is the law of that men, Jewish men, they have to have children. What's the word? They are obliged to have children. So if they don't have children, and we have two laws clashing one with the other, the one is the ritual, and the other is the law that of the obligation to procreate. So the law that obliges a man to procreate takes precedence over the law that forbids him to have sex in years of famine. And I think this is a nice example of how a text from Eretz Israel is then taken over and reworked in Babylonia. Yes?
Why don't you translate by name children? Isn't it a collective noun, boys and girls? But doesn't the Talmud say that you don't fulfill your obligation until you have a boy and a girl? Only then have you fulfilled your obligation and procreation?
Right. I'll answer that. Not the Talmud says it. It's Beit Shammai who say it. Okay. Beit Hillel say you need two banim, sons. So it's a machloket. And I intentionally translate. I mean, this is exactly the issue. We are not trying in any way to somehow cover up or soften what the text is saying. Because we think that one of the things we have to emphasize when we read these texts is what is going on here? In what language are they speaking? Because I think that if they wanted to say children, they would have said either Yeladim or Banim Uvanot. They would have said it. They have the tools to say it. That is not to say that they don't mean to say Banim Uvanot, but I think that by stressing that we translate it as sons, we are doing what they did, and that is to give precedence to sons as more important than daughters, because they definitely do it. So you don't agree? Yeah.
I just wanted to say, if you take a look at, you have to realize that Perua Rebu is the first mitzvah, means it's a biblical injunction. This is a rabbinic injunction. A rabbinic injunction cannot nullify a biblical one. And you see this also by the statement of Rabbi Yossi, provided a deuce on a day of immersion. If you take a look at a woman's fertility period, the day after immersion, she's the most fertile.
That is. I would never argue against that. In fact, I agree with you, because I just said that the Babylonian Talmud, when it says these two injunctions sort of clash one with one another, then of course the one with procreation takes precedence. But I don't think that's what the Yerushalmi is saying. The Yerushalmi is not saying that procreation doesn't take precedence. The Yerushalmi says, if you're going to do this, not only are you not going to fulfill the procreation, you're going to endanger what you already have. So in fact, it's a pikuach nefesh, what the Yerushalmi is saying. And it's a criticism. And the Bavli makes it as a sort of, you know, clash of cultures. Okay? Yes?
You could also compare the fact that the Talmud says that Noah was not allowed to have relations or his family.
Yeah, it's in the same text, by the way. It's here. I just brought a piece of it here.
And also, even in this, coming up in next week's parasha, with regards to Moshe and why he separated from Yocheved.
Yes, of course, but that's a different question, because it's not the question. I mean, Noah is exactly the situation here. It's a situation where engaging in sex in the ark was dangerous. It was pikuach nefesh not to do it. In the case of Moses, we don't know if it's pikuach nefesh. Well, there's something else going on there.
Well, the Medrash says that the reason why Amram separated from Yocheved,
yes, of course, exactly,
because of the fact that
that's
the Gezeirah against the son.
Absolutely, so. Absolutely. That I would go with you in that respect. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So I have two more texts, I think, that I brought here, which also are found in the Talmud, and I just want to show that the issue of the rain and procreation is ever present in our text. So I don't know, can anybody guess what is going to happen now? Yeah?
Something else that we produce.
Rabbi Yochanan said, three keys in the hands of the Holy One, blessed be He, were not given into the hands of an agent, and these are the key of rain, and the key of a pregnant woman, and the key of the resurrection. So you can see here that actually the key of rain and the key of pregnancy is so closely associated that we can go back to our metaphor where the rain itself is some sort of impregnating, but perhaps we can go back to your suggestion that we use impregnating here. The key of rain and the key of rain, as it is written, and God will open for you His bounteous store, the heavens to provide rain for your land in season. The key of a pregnant woman, whence, as it is written, now God remembered Rachel, God heeded her and opened her womb. So they use the word mafteach, and the word is patach. Patach, yiftach lecha. The first one is Yiftach Hashem lecha et otzaru atov, ויזכור אלוהים את רחל ויפתח את רחמה, and then of course you have מפתח של תחיית המתים. So you can see here that the rain and pregnancy, the keys are associated. Yes.
This is precisely what we started with, the word gevurah, gevurot kishamim.
Yeah.
Only God, this is the strength of, when we use the word gevurah, we're talking about this God's strength. Only God can produce life, only God can produce rain, only God can produce tchiyat hamesim, the resurrection of the dead. This is the power of God. That's what's called gevurot kishamim. Instead of translating it like you said, it's masculine and feminine. No.
No, it proves God is masculine.
Yeah. That would be my answer. No, of course, as I said, this is my interpretation because it's an interpretation. Because, of course,
it's called the Gvurot in the Shemot Esrei.
Yes. I wouldn't argue against him being called Gvurot. I would still ask, where does it come from?
We have rain, we have resurrection, we have those things.
Yes, of course. And it comes from here. And it comes from here.
That's right.
And it comes from here, not the other way around.
I understand. But the word Gvurot is not necessarily a masculine word.
Why not? I think what the lady up there said is the answer. Can you say it loud?
It proves God is masculine. That's the point.
I think so. I'm afraid. Okay. And my last, I think it's my last example, is, I mean, we had Rabbi Yochanan, and now we have Reish Lakish, and Reish Lakish says, what is the meaning of the verse, he will close the skies? Ve'atzar et ha-shamayim. When the heaven ceases to bring forth dew and rain, they are similar to a woman who is in labor but does not give birth. So we have again a sexual metaphor, although interestingly enough, an opposite sexual metaphor here. Now the rain is like a woman when it doesn't come. Thus said Reish Lakish in the name of Bar Kappara, closure is said of rains and it is said of a woman. Closure is said of a woman as it is written, for Hashem had closed fast every womb. And closing is said of rains, it is written, and he will close the sky so that there will be no rain. Birth is said of a woman, and so on. But it's interesting here that the metaphor is working in this case in the opposite direction. But we had the situation where liftoach, you open the heavens, and liftoach et harechem, and here you have latzor, you close the skies and you close a woman's womb. So the metaphor is still being powerfully used here to describe the two things happening together. So thank you very much.
I'm sure Tal is willing to answer questions. Do you call people yourself?
I can call people. Oh, do you want to?
No, I don't want to.
Maybe you know who deserves to speak more than me. Okay, go ahead.
We'll see.
I have two questions in terms of how you wrote your commentary on Titus. One is with regards to the story about the Kiddush Hashem and the ripping off of the woman's clothing. And more interestingly to me, in terms of the yellow...
Which one? In Tanit?
The top page.
It's in a couple of different places.
You bet all of our boy. Right. The one who was a jailer. Why was he bet all of our boy? Because he safeguarded women prisoners from...
Oh. Is that the one you're talking about? But Patakaka, who is in the Yerushalmi? It's not in the Bavli. The Bavli is the one who sees this woman walking in the marketplace and he throws blood on her so that she looks...
Not walking, he was discovered in the marketplace and he was a jailer.
A what? And a jailer. Oh, and he separates men and women. Okay. So.
And then the second
I also
one,
spilled blood on it.
Yeah, that's the... Yeah, okay.
The second one I actually find probably even more interesting, especially if, egalitarian feminism is... With regards to the end of the Masechet, when we talk about
Lo Ayu Yamim Tovim Yisrael,
yes.
So of course, One of the interesting things is most of the things that I brought here come from chapter 1 in the Masechet. And this story that you're talking about comes from chapter 3, or these stories about the blood and about the jailer and about, and of course there's the parallel ones in the Yerushalmi, like the story of Pantakaka who saves a woman from, she wants to free her husband from jail, and she, in order to free him from jail, she's willing to go to become a prostitute, and he saves her by selling something and freeing her husband from jail. And so these sort of stories, they come in chapter 3. And chapter 3 in the Masechet is, of course, the chapter where you have the story of Choni in the Mishnah. And so the result is that because we have Choni, who is a great rainmaker, both the Yerushalmi and the Bavli, in this context of chapter 3, tell you stories about great rainmakers. And one of the fascinating questions is, in what respect is rainmaking associated with women and with gender and with gender relations? And I mean, you brought this story about the jailer, and we also mentioned the story about the one with the blood, but I think the most powerful story is actually the story about Abba Chilkiah, who has these two scholars who come and ask him to pray for rain, and then he says, he takes his wife up to the roof and says to her, let's pray for rain. And they pray, and the rain comes from her direction. And when it comes from her, then they go down and they say, well, you don't need me, rain's already coming. So they do it. So, of course, the question is that this is a question where the woman comes in, and, of course, in the other questions. And I tried to look at each one of these stories separately when I read the entire Masechet, and I gave various interpretations, because when you write a commentary, you have to deal with every single aspect separately. But I did also, in the end, come to the general conclusion that it seems that in order for rain to come, you need extraordinary people to pray for rain, and they have to be extraordinary in that they don't have. It's not because they're great scholars of Torah, which we sometimes think is the most important aspect. They have to be very pious people. And one of the interesting things about being pious in rabbinic concept in these chapters is that if you're going to be pious, you are going to make sure that the normal hierarchical order of the way the relationships between sexes work is maintained rigidly. And therefore, in jail, he puts men separately and women separately so that there won't be any hanky-panky or whatever. Or that's why when some men are going after this woman and there may be some sort of taking advantage of a married woman or an unmarried woman, so he spills blood on her so that people will think she's menstruating. And this is a Babylonian story, and perhaps I should say here that I have learned from people like Jacob Ellman how absolutely horrifying for the Persians, and in context of the Persian culture, is the impurity of menstruation. And so this is a very powerful story that you find in the Bavli and not in the Yerushalmi. And I don't know why the rain comes from the woman's side, because this story has a parallel in the Yerushalmi, and no woman is going up on the roof there and praying. So this is also something that the Bavli is bringing out in this question. So maybe, but this is only a speculation, maybe because in this context of this chapter, all these people who pray for rain are not great scholars, they're pious people. They want to bring this to an extreme, and the most extreme example of somebody who's not a scholar is a woman.
What about then the
I looked a lot at the last chapter, of course, about the dancing and this on Yom Kippur and on Tu B'Av.
Yom Kippur.
It says both. לא היו ימים טובים לישראל כט"ו באב ויום הכיפורים. לא היו ימים טובים לישראל כט"ו באב ויום הכיפורים, שבהם היו, and so on and so forth. And one of the things that I think is that this is such an unusual text. It's so unconventional, and it's so difficult to know what's going on, that I have to
In the end, and this is one of the things that I say, which always, I get problems with people like Judy, who are sort of so text-oriented, is I say, I can't believe that anybody would invent such a text. This is a reflection of something historical that had actually gone on. And in my opinion, it had gone on before the destruction of the temple. And this is a very, very old memory for something before that. And then I also say that it's also true that, or I think that when I say that it's not just on Tu B'Av and Yom Kippur, my, so to speak, historical evidence for it comes from Yom Kippur and not from Tu B'Av, because we have a very weird description of Yom Kippur found in the works of a church father from Antioch by the name of John Chrysostomus. And he wrote a treatise, which was an anti-Judaizing treatise, because he had a problem. Many of his constituents were finding the celebrations of the high festivals of the Jews very attractive. And he had to persuade his constituents not to go there. And so he describes to us what is going on in the high holidays for the Jews. So that is not Tu B'Av, that is Yom Kippur. And in this description he says they go around naked, not naked, barefoot, and they dance through the streets. And I say, wow, this is what we have in Tanit. So I have to say that I think we have here a historical glimpse of something that was going on. And maybe it's associated with a text from the book of Judges.
It's interesting to me that it seems like by ascribing the rain both masculine and feminine, language and conceptualizations, it seems like maybe it's not so much a binary system that's being ascribed to these elements in terms of how it relates to gender. I was wondering if you have anything to say on the lack of binary concreteness in this text.
So, of course, I think we have to see that there's the metaphor which was created by the Mishnah. And then the Amoraim come and look at it. And I brought some examples. I have more. The text is full of other examples. It goes on and on. And particularly chapter 1 in the Talmud is so full of additional texts. I even have a text there where it says, the next part in the Mishnah, it says, and if it hasn't rained for months and months and months, then you mema'atim benisuim ve'erusin, you don't even marry, or it's not just that you don't have sex, you don't marry and you don't lintoah and you don't live not, you don't plant and you don't build and you don't marry and you don't get betrothed. So you have this, it's even stronger. And then in the Talmud, even when they interpret what bnia and netia means, they interpret that as procreation and marriage. So it's such a strong metaphor. It's working all the time there. But I think that when you say it's not binary, I think that the metaphor in the Mishnah is very clear. But once it comes to the Talmud sort of loosens it out, and then it can sort of turn around and it can cross-dress.
I just wonder what the implications are for, in such a text, describing both the feminine role in procreation and the masculine role, both to the rain, what type of impact that would have compared to a more, specific, this is masculine, this is feminine type of discussion.
Well, it's metaphor. Right. I think that we would get less of it if we were dealing with halakha.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes?
I am a bit concerned about your presentation, because it leaves me with, and so what?
Good question.
Good. Now, the idea of the sexualization of many aspects of life, or interpretation through a sexual idea and patterns, it is not really, did not start with the Babylonian Talmud or the Mishnah or the Bible. You find it in many civilizations. Even civilization did not know at all, did not encounter the Jews. Look, southern, the Maya, the Incas, they have Mama Dakcha, whatever it's called. You know, it is very common. And what is so strange that the Bible, the rabbis are using this kind of ideas and terminology. I don't find it at all so strange. Actually, it would be strange if it would not exist. But what especially I don't understand, really, when you say, oh, poletet zera, poletet shichvat zera. But it is obvious, you know. Poletet shichvat zera. Not because she produced anything new, but she is poletet what she brought. So what you are saying, it produced something new. Nothing new. Okay. It is bolea, polet.
Yeah. Okay.
And I can give you many other examples. Sorry, I have left a little bit. What's the point?
Okay, I'll start with the question of what's the point. What's the point of what we do at all? I mean, why are we reading the Talmud at all? Why are we trying to read it and interpret it? Now, I'm not saying that you say, what's strange about it? I didn't say it's strange. I didn't use the word strange at all. What I said, and I'm saying it again, is I looked at the way people interpreted the word Gevurot Gshamim, and I didn't see my interpretation before. That is not to say that it couldn't have been discovered by somebody else. But I think that you have to set your mind to thinking in that direction. And I also have to say that I think that in the past, people intentionally set their minds to thinking in the opposite direction, not when they read the Maya, and not when they read, I don't know, Aristotle, when they read the Talmud. They would go about saying, it can't be happening here. So I'm not trying to say that it's revolutionary or strange. I'm just trying to show something that people didn't do before. And I wouldn't have myself done it before if I hadn't initiated this project. That's all I'm saying. Now, as to Poletet Shichvat Zera. Now, I have to say that in this respect, I have found, and because I brought the texts as they were, just to show you that this is what we have in all the texts, and I did it rather mechanically, but I did go through the texts themselves. And I have to tell you that sometimes you're right and sometimes you're wrong. In some cases, that's exactly what it says, particularly with relation to the question of Sinai. We have, in relation to the text of Sinai, they say that why weren't women allowed to, why did they say, Al tikrav el ha'isha shloshet yamim? Because then they have the question of what happens if a woman, after she had sex in the next 3 days, she poletet shichvat zera, that it comes out. And in this case, you're absolutely right, this refers to what she got in. But we do have among these texts that say exactly this, that for a woman to become pregnant, yeah, she has to liflot be'atzma, and it's something else. It is not what she gets. And so we have actually two sorts of use of this expression, and they are different texts. And I know I lumped them all together, but they don't have the same meaning. It just happens to be two different uses of the same expression.
Why don't we take two more questions?
Yeah, okay.
About that question about the confusion and the flipping of the metaphor, yeah, whether the earth or the rain, yeah, is the feminine. And I guess it's also about this question of the meaning of shichvat zera attached, yeah, to a woman. How does that line up with the rabbinic understanding of the genetic contribution of men and women? I mean, having in procreation, knowing what rain is, knowing what water is, and then seeing the earth as feminine, seems like the one that's counterintuitive according to the rabbinic understanding. It seems to make more sense to understand the rain as being the feminine aspect.
No, we, I tried to do it before, and I'm going to try it even stronger now in answer to what was asked here. There's a difference between what the Mishnah is saying and what the Talmud is saying, and the confusion only occurs in the Talmud. And one of the things that we see in the Talmud is also that we have a sort of a shift in the concept of what is going on from a point of view of procreation between the traditions in the land of Israel and the traditions in Babylonia. And because right next to what we have here with Rabbi Yochanan and what he says, we have the story about the three partners in the creation of a person. Shlosha shutafim ba'adam. And it's very interesting that this tradition seems to have the same tradition we have in the... Now, I have to remember this, because this is getting complicated. So I have to do this quite correctly. And if I don't, I will have to excuse myself, because I know that I'm going to say something next to the exact meaning of the text. In Babylonia, you have Shlosha Shutafim Ba'adam, but it's quite clear that you have actually... You can cut it in two. Half is contributed to God, and men and women each contribute, so to speak, a quarter. Whereas in Eretz Israel, it's really divided into three, and each one gives the same contribution. This is very complicated, and you have to look at the text, but I think that the more important concept is, and the reason why you have the flipping of the metaphors, is actually because in Eretz Israel, because there's a different appropriation concept in Babylonia than in Eretz Israel, and some of the things that I showed here, even though you have Rabbi Yochanan saying it, and even though you have Reish Lakish saying it, you don't have these texts in Eretz Israel. So even though they assign them to scholars from Eretz Israel, they actually refer them to Babylonia. I think this
last question.
Thank you so much for a really thought-provoking presentation. And you talked a lot tonight about the construction of gender in these texts. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the social reality in these texts. Especially, I think for me it's very true that women were generally the face of mourning in antiquity. And I'm wondering how Masechet Tanit like allows that to shine through or purposely obscures that.
Okay.
Could you repeat the question? Sorry.
Oh, sorry. She says that that women, because women are sort of... She wants to know about social reality. And the women are really sort of associated with mourning. Does that have to do with Masechet Tanit? So first of all, mourning and Tanit is not the same thing. Although some of the things that we see that happen in Tanit happen in mourning too. What is forbidden in... when you're in Tanit is also forbidden in mourning, particularly the Mlacha and Neilat HaSandal and Tashmish HaMitah, but not Achila V'Shtiyah. That is of course allowed for a mourner, but there are similarities, it's true. Now the social reality is actually a different question. Women are clearly associated with mourning in that they have this important role of being the
kings.
Mekonenot, the women who do this, whatever. It's associated in the entire Middle East with women. But the question of social reality that should interest us with regard to Tanit, which is different, is are women at all required to fast? And the reason this is a relevant question is because most of Seder Moed, in principle, we could have expected that women are not expected to participate in it at all. And indeed, and this is what I was fascinated in, is that Masechet Tanit doesn't, the Mishnah, doesn't ever specifically mention women as participants. And the only place that it turns out that women are required to fast are two texts in the Talmud. And now I have to try and remember what they were. I know that there were two texts. One of them is that, and this is very similar to mourning, that a woman, they say that you're not allowed to wash and to do all those things, but a bride is allowed, even while fasting, to wash herself, because she's sort of a bride.
And so you understand that if a bride is allowed to, other women are not. And the other text where women are also mentioned is that pregnant women and nursing women are exempt from participating in the fast. So if pregnant women and nursing women are exempt, it means that other women are supposed to participate in the fast. And this is the only way you can know that this is expected of them. I hope this answers the question.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm Stephanie Sigmund. I'm the director of the program in Jewish Gender and Women's Studies. I want to thank you all for coming. I also want to thank the library for co-sponsoring this event and putting it into their book series. I want to thank Professor Judith Hauptman for being our moderator. And most of all, I'd like to thank Professor Talilan.